Welcome to the Razor's Ink podcast with your host, Jonathan Farini. Among movies about nuclear war, more than a few of them are about averting nuclear war. Others still present in graphic detail the horrors of such an event. What's often missing, though, is a thoughtful and yet very realistic portrayal of the people left to pick up what pieces remain. So pour yourself a drink, pull up a chair, and hear Jonathan's take on movies, television, and today, another of those underrated and overlooked movies, this one showing the perseverance of humanity, even when humanity is wiped out. Here's your host, Jonathan Farini.
I'm recording this podcast on Memorial Day. A few days earlier, the President of the United States introduced the Golden Dome missile defense system designed to protect North America from nuclear attack. It will be completed within 3 years at an estimated cost of $175 billion. On the Beach is a movie about the aftermath of nuclear war. It was released on December 17, 1959. I was 1 year old. Fidel Castro came to power in Cuba on January 1, 1959. President Eisenhower gave his farewell address on January 17, 1961, warning of the military-industrial complex. Translation, war is profitable. The Bay of Pigs covert operation by the United States to topple Castro occurred on April 17, 1961. The Cuban Missile Crisis, pitting the United States against the Soviet Union in a naval blockade, possibly leading to nuclear war between the two nuclear powers, occurred between October 14, 1962 through October 29, 1962. The United States' involvement in Vietnam began in 1965 and didn't end until 1973. Those early 60s were harrowing times, including duck and cover exercises at school.
Duck and cover!
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. Duck and cover. Paul and Patty know this. No matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb. Duck and cover.
And monthly nuclear air raid siren drills. In many school and civil buildings, hallways were denoted as fallout shelters. Ask your parents or grandparents. A potential nuclear showdown between the Soviet Union and the United States manifested itself in B-movies throughout the 50s and 60s, and most notably the Godzilla movie about a monster born from radioactive fallout was released in Japan. On the Beach has shown sporadically from decade to decade, but I thought it was time to bring it out again and reflect on its message.
And our scientists disagree as to when radiation will reach Australia. The atomic war has ended, but the Prime Minister reports no proof of survival of human life anywhere except here.
If you're expecting Hiroshima-style devastation after a nuclear attack, blood, gore, or zombies, you'll be disappointed. The message of On the Beach is about a group of survivors and their attempt to hold on to a semblance of humanity and normalcy inside Australia until the radioactive cloud drifts down from the northern hemisphere and kills everybody from radioactive poisoning. The movie is set in 1964, which eerily provides a lead-up to Kubrick's 1964 Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb classic. There's nothing to love about the bomb inside On the Beach. The movie was directed by Stanley Kramer, who brought us The Defiant Ones in 1958. See my podcast, starring Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis. On the Beach stars Gregory Peck, Ava Gardner, Anthony Perkins, who played Norman in Psycho in 1960, and Fred Astaire. You'll enjoy a fine supporting cast as well. Director Stanley Kramer concludes the movie with a tattered Salvation Army banner above deserted Melbourne stating, "There's still time, brother." A chilling warning. It's ironic to me a movie exploring a seminal theme of human survival lost money at the box office and was met with mixed reviews. Maybe it's the absence of Hiroshima-style destruction, blood, gore, and zombies walking about. The film was adopted from the novel by the same name, written by Neville Shuta, a prolific novelist and aeronautical engineer. The screenplay was written by John Paxton with a fine screenwriting pedigree, including The Wild One, starring Marlon Brando. There isn't much in common between the book and screenplay, creating animosity between the author and director. For example, there's no explanation for who started the nuclear exchange inside the movie, but the book goes into great detail about the geopolitical tumult, beginning the nuclear exchange, wiping out North America, placing our characters into motion inside a nuclear submarine, heading to Australia, which lies in the southern hemisphere where the radioactive debris won't approach for about 5 months. I side with Kramer. Who cares who started the war? The damage is done. Let's make a film about the last vestiges of human interaction, love, and parting, the real collateral damage of any war, which are explored adroitly inside the film. Ernest Gold provided the musical score and later would provide the score for the movie Exodus, starring Paul Newman in 1960. Gold had worked with Kramer in The Defiant Ones, and you'll hear a regional pop song from The Defiant Ones inside On the Beach.
Because you take me for granted. I know women aren't supposed to like that sort of thing, but somehow I do. I've been treated in every other way, like a child. And sometimes like things I probably deserved.
Gold must have loved that song, but it supports a maxim of this podcast. Nothing happens in film by accident. Here's a summary of the film, and I'll return with my takes at the end. In 1964, World War III has devastated the Northern Hemisphere, killing all humans. Air currents are slowly carrying the fallout to the Southern Hemisphere, where Melbourne, Australia, will be the last major city on Earth to perish. The American nuclear submarine USS Sawfish, commanded by Captain Dwight Towers, Gregory Peck, arrives in Melbourne and is placed under Royal Australian Navy Command.
I've got an assignment for you. It's a reasonably important appointment as things go these days. I'm sorry I can't be on one of our own ships. The seagoing, though, and better than sitting around your bottom. Liaison officer aboard the American submarine Sawfish. She just docked. Nuclear powered, of course. You report to the Captain Towers. That'll be all, Holmes.
Peter Holmes, played by Anthony Perkins, is a young Australian naval officer with a wife, Mary, and infant child assigned to be Towers' liaison.
Sir, would it be possible to discuss the duration of this appointment?
No. But I can give you a review and say 4 months.
Oh, thanks very much, sir, because I'd like to be home if possible when... Is there any official estimate as to how much longer?
The bigger heads, the finger in the wind boys, they say calculating the rate of drift or what have you, about 5 months before it gets here. That's why I say four for a view.
Holmes invites Towers to his home for a party where Towers meets Julian Osborne, played by Fred Astaire, a depressive nuclear scientist who helped build the bombs.
Well, it should be pinned on somebody. And you scientists are the likely ones as far as I can see. You built the bomb. You experimented with it, tested it, and exploded it.
Now, just a moment, Morgan.
Thanks to you, chaps, a moment is about all we have.
Every man who ever worked on this thing told you what would happen. The scientists signed petition after petition.
Julian, please.
But nobody listened. There was a choice. It was build the bombs and use them, or risk that the United States, the Soviet Union, and the rest of us would find some way to go on living.
Huh. That's wishful thinking, if ever I heard it.
I'm not against wishful thinking, not now.
Look, they pushed us too far. They didn't think we'd fight no matter what they did.
And they were wrong. We fought, we expunged them. We didn't do such a bad job on ourselves. With the interesting result that the background level of radiation in this very room is 9 times what it was a year ago. Don't you know that? 9 times.
We're all doomed, you know. The whole silly, drunken, pathetic lot of us.
And Moira Davidson, played by Ava Gardner, a lonely alcoholic with whom Towers develops a tentative attraction. It's easy to fall for Ava, and Moira falls in love with Towers, but he can't return her feelings because he can't bring himself to admit his wife and children in the United States are dead. A new scientific hypothesis suggests radiation levels may disperse before reaching the southern hemisphere. The Australians also detect an incomprehensible continuous Morse code signal coming from the west coast of the United States, where there should be nobody alive to send it. Towers is ordered to take the sawfish with Peter and Julian to investigate. Surfacing in Alaska, Julian finds the radiation levels even more lethal, and the dispersal thesis is wrong.
All right, Mr. Osborne. You can take your readings now. Chief?
Where's the ECM?
Aye, aye, sir. ECM fully extended, sir.
It's high, isn't it?
It's higher than it is in mid-Pacific. At least 30 points in the red. That takes care of Jorgensen's theory.
There is no salvation for Australia. The subsurface is next in San Francisco. Sawfish finds the city devoid of life. A crew member with family in the city deserts and swims ashore so he can die at home. As we peer through the periscope, we look into San Francisco to see the beautiful city devoid of all people, traffic, and movement. A ghost town, literally and figuratively. The sailor choosing to stay behind and die from radiation poisoning shows us humanity. The desire to die at home, albeit alone and amongst the dead, secreted inside their homes and businesses, rather than in the street like dogs.
Captain, how long is it before I feel anything?
A few days. A week. There's no rule.
Well, the weather's okay if the wind had died down a little. Captain, I didn't mean any disrespect or anything yesterday. I want you to understand that, but I'd rather be home here to have it than in Australia. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Is there anything you want before we go?
I'm okay.
We won't be coming back.
I know.
You'll get pretty sick. Have you got anything to take?
I got 200 drugstores to choose from. Good luck.
The submarine next surfaces in San Diego at a refinery, pinpointed as the source of the mysterious Morse signals. A crew member leaves the sub and enters the refinery, only to discover the power source is still running and a telegraph key has become entangled in a window shade's pull cord. And a half-full Coca-Cola bottle, a strong metaphor for the former iconic symbol of America. Each time the ocean breeze filled with radiation isotopes blows the shade, the Coke bottle randomly taps the telegraph key. This is salient to this viewer. It's America lost forever, saying goodbye to Americans leaving home to die a certain death. Remember the irreverent Coke machine inside Strangelove in 1965, folks? Nothing happens in film by accident, and Kubrick may have been impressed by the Coke bottle tapping out Morse code. Sawfish returns to Australia to await the inevitable arrival of the radiation, which will kill everybody in a slow, torturous fashion. Towers is reunited with Moira. He learns that all U.S. Navy personnel in Brisbane are dead, and he has been given command of all remaining U.S. naval forces, which is ironic, because there are no remaining U.S. naval forces. He's a sailor in a navy of one. See the irony? Our protagonist insists on maintaining some semblance of normalcy, despite the inevitable. This is the human condition on full display. For instance, Osborne bought the fastest Ferrari in Australia and wins the Australian Grand Prix, in which many racers with nothing left to lose die in fiery crashes. Fulfilling Tower's wish to fish for trout, another grasp at normalcy, Moira used her connections to get the trout season opened up early. Towers and Moira go on a fishing trip to the country. As drunken revelers sing,
"Oh, Sing Matilda, oh, Sing Matilda, you come a walk, Sing Matilda with me."
In the hotel bar, Towers and Moira make love in their room. Again, the most intimate of human relations. It's a big move for Towers because he must let go of beloved memories and fidelity for a few last moments of living. Towers learns the first of his crew members has radiation sickness. There's little time left. Towers takes a vote amongst his crew who decide they want to return to the United States to die. We see the crew, like the sailor who went ashore in San Francisco, prefer to die at home, even if home is populated by only the dead.
You all know the situation. I've given leave to many of you to stay here for personal reasons. It's understandable why some of you might prefer this. I think that the rest of you are entitled to decide what you'd like to do. I'd like you to think about it. Take a vote if you need to. Give me your decision by this evening. I think that's all.
Captain, we've already taken a vote. We'd like to head for home.
Osborne shuts himself in a garage with his Ferrari and starts the engine to end his life by carbon monoxide poisoning. In a macabre scene reminiscent of the concentration camp prisoners standing outside gas chambers masquerading as showers, the public queue up in long lines to receive government-issued suicide pills. We're reunited with Peter, wife, and baby, who prepare to take their suicide pills. They reminisce about the day they met on the beach. Do you need Hiroshima-style devastation, blood, gore, and zombies, when you watch this family about to commit suicide? Towers says farewell to Moira at the docks. Choosing duty over love, he takes the Sawfish back to sea. Heartbroken, Moira watches from a cliff as the Sawfish submerges. Kramer cuts to the streets of Melbourne, empty and silent. A Salvation Army street banner, seen several times before in the film, reads, "There is still time, brother." Kramer's ominous warning to us all in 1959. We evidently didn't get the message if you refer back to my history lesson at the beginning of the podcast. The film lost money and received mixed reviews. It surfaced as a remake on Australian TV in 2000 and a documentary about the film, including the Schutt and Kramer battles, was released in 2013. The U.S. Department of Defense refused to cooperate in the production of the film, not allowing access to its nuclear-powered submarines. The British submarine HMS Andrew was used to portray the Sawfish. Additional resources were supplied by the Royal Australian Navy. Having lived a life of nearly two-thirds of a century, I've learned if it sounds too good to be true, it likely isn't. Even if a golden shield was 100% effective, pay particular attention to which geographical boundaries it covers and doesn't. I hope I'm wrong, but any shield, like a dartboard or a target at a gun range, invites provocateurs. It won't be in my lifetime, but wouldn't it be wonderful to save the cost of a golden shield, agree to an international nuclear disarmament, and create peace by feeding and healing the world, literally and figuratively? See my podcast, Shoes of the Fisherman, where a nuclear showdown was averted by a single act of charity. On a final note, I've known my share of Australians and know them to be very charming, gracious, and beautiful people. It's no surprise Australia was chosen to be the final nation left standing inside this film. On this Memorial Day, I'm thankful we're not dealing with the issues put forth in the movie On the Beach. May we continue to be so thankful. Until I see you next time, please leave behind a soft footprint. And good day, mate.
On the Beach isn't graphic, but it's not an easy watch.
It is, however, a poignant one, and one well worth your time. The entire movie, by the way, is available for free on YouTube. You've been listening to the Razor's Ink podcast with Jonathan Farini. Be sure to check out Jonathan's collection of fiction at the Jonathan B. Farini Story Collection at jonathanfarini.com. Also, look for Jonathan's latest short story, The Line in the Lake, already published in the online magazine Mobius. It's been published once again, this time in the June issue of The Anniversary in This Town, published by Scars Publications. Find it at scars.tv or drop an email to razorsincpodcast@gmail.com.